Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 1st, 2004. Today's session number is MED 2004-04. Today's speaker is David Mezenbring, and the lesson for today is Broadening Community to Better Discern the Summons. One People, One Planet, One Church Summoned. Let's listen in.
Right after Jesus is resurrected and he's walking, he joins a couple of disciples on the road. And as he first joins them and they invite him to walk with them, he's their guest. And they teach him about the events of the recent days. You don't know what's happened, and they tell him what's going on. And then he moves into the role of being the teacher. By the end of that walk, he's explaining to them and helping them understand the events of the recent days. Should I read it, or are you willing to take my word for it? I asked for advice and you gave it and I didn't hear it.
Did you ask if you should read it?
Yeah.
And I said, no, we know the story.
Yeah, good. The two that he joined come to the point of at the end of their departure, and he's going to go on ahead. He has been their host now. He's been hosting their education. First he was their guest, and he was their host. And now they say, no, you come and join us. So he becomes their guest again. And then at the table, he's the one who blesses the food, which is a role of the host. He goes back and forth between guest and host. Same thing with the woman at the well. If you read it, you can see he goes back and forth between being her guest, she's giving him water, and being her host, he's telling her about her life. Back and forth. I think that is a good dynamic for practicing ecumenism. Being fluid about when we're the guest and when we're the host, and going back and forth. Although traditionally what's been a stumbling block for us is that we always got to be the host, you know, we always got to be in charge. We're always in the judging position, is this right or wrong? And then thirdly, strangership. There's a Finnish port chaplain who wrote a book called Strangership. I thought, what a strange word, never seen it, never understand it. But if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. Friendship, we don't have any problems with friendship. We understand what friendship is. Strangership is simply the interaction, the dynamic that goes on between strangers, which is very powerful. I used to ruminate on it when I did a lot of hitchhiking, because I was so impressed by the dynamic that occurs between strangers when they actually trust each other enough to enter into some kind of an encounter. And to say that when I hitchhiked during the days I was doing theological study, I'd find all these people who, when they heard I was in divinity school, wanted to have their annual religious discussion. And sometimes I felt amazingly blessed by those things. All of us have had the experience of being a stranger and being accepted, and what a powerful, really, almost more than, well, I don't want to demean friendship. Friendship is a very powerful dynamic too. But strangership is a concept that I've learned to look for more and more and appreciate and value more and more. Partly because it involves a certain vulnerability. I did a session the last time we were holding on. I don't remember the title, but it was about this notion. The vulnerability that it goes along with being a stranger, and the power that we access when we make ourselves vulnerable. Poor chaplains know a lot about this, because when you're bored, I don't, Maria does this, I just do the administration, but she boards those ships, and you walk up that gangway, and you have no idea what the nationality of the crew is going to be, and whether they're going to be busy, and whether they're interested or not. And you're with them, they're strangers. And you are their guest on board their ship, but we also host them in our port. There's that going back and forth dynamic a lot. And in a way, we sometimes open up to strangers and share with them in ways we dare not with our friends, right? And there's a lot of power in that. So if we approached other faiths that way, other people, not just faiths, because the whole household of life is bigger than conversation about religious faiths. It's got to be. It's got to include the ecological movement. It's got to recognize that our life depends on everyone else in this whole inhabited earth. This is a little disparate, but another point I want to make here is the difference between. I want to argue against pursuing ecumenism as church merger, put it that way, which is a lot of what the focus has been for the last 100 years, and it hasn't been very successful, and it can't be very successful. We talked earlier about how communities are built around some standards of sameness, right? To join one denomination or one religion, you subscribe to certain principles. We use the same books if we're Lutherans or Methodists or Presbyterians or Episcopalians. We've got our book, our liturgy, our hymnals. And the kind of unity and diversity. The point I'm trying to talk about here is unity and diversity versus diversities related in koinonia. Now let's take it first. Unity and diversity, what I mean by that is that institutional unions aren't going to tolerate much diversity. There's limits to how much diversity an institution or a group, a defined group, is going to accept or tolerate or allow. And when I did this talk a few years ago, somebody in the village argued against trying to merge denominations because he was in one which at that point was pretty open about including people of various sexual orientations. And he didn't want to unite with a community that was closed to that. As you broaden the boundaries, you're going to run into political limits. Look at political parties. They can't get too broad or they lose too many people who just aren't going to go there. I don't think institutional union, the religious institutions are self-perpetuating anyway. I mean, the worst weekend of the year for me is when I have to go to my synod assembly. And it's all about, we are here for the world, but when you study the budget, it's all about, we are here to promote our institution. We're really, everything we do is I broke a calculator once, trying to calculate what percentage of the budget went to Lutherans, one way or another. And I couldn't, it was two, that well, actually, the break came from what percentage went to non-Lutherans. It was too tiny of a fraction for me to calculate in that, In the budget of the Florida Bahamas Synod. It all went one way or another to Lutherans or to building up our organization. Now, we need the organization. I got to belong somewhere. I got to have a center that I'm disciplined to. But I think it's a mistake to approach ecumenism as how do we get this institution to merge with that institution. What would be a better first step, I think, would be to look for some diversities related in fellowship or in koinonia. There's where we get the basic contact that breeds love. We learn to love each other because we have contact with each other. Somebody made the comment in one of the sessions about, it wasn't until they start to meet gay and lesbian people that they could like them. And as long as we fear the unknown, right? That's a basic principle of social science. So maybe we fear people of other faiths because we don't know them. And then when we begin to have a little more experience, we can find the way to love. And there's a lot in Scripture that suggests that that's really the glue that holds us together.
Just to kind of give you a parallel piece, in studies of psychology and culture, developmental cultures, anthropology, there's a basic dynamic of differentiation and then integration and then differentiation that runs through. You know, you look at either child or adult development, you look at cultures and their development, you look at ecosystems. Gregory Bateson is a guy who looked at, and the notion there is that's basically, if you really look at it, when evolution, which is a process of differentiation and then integration, same with child and adult development, it's basically, we're talking about the mechanism or the machine of learning. So that's how learning occurs.
That's good.
Okay? But so bring it to the topic you're talking about. If you need to have what kills the, you know, the oikonomy, whatever that African word is, there.
Greek.
Yeah, sounds more African. Oikonomy. What kills it is when you decide at some point this is it. Mm. This differentiation is it, or no? This integration is it, as opposed to the alternative notion. Say it's going to continue. So wherever you are, how whatever the belonging or sameness, you know, that you have found today, guess what? You can't stop it. It's gonna. There's gonna be differentiation there. There's something's gonna split off, and that then leaves opportunity for new learning. I mean, you know, you get the new stuff, and then the next higher level. Higher level is probably the wrong one, because I don't necessarily know that we can understand its progress. But the next place of integration, which is now sowing the seeds for the next place of differentiation. Mm-hmm. And in organizational theory, which is where I work, you know, you just see it all the time. I mean, why do companies, you know, grow and then they split off and then they grow, you know, and then the world splits and then they come and they merge.
If John McMurray's Gifford lectures were on the rhythm of withdrawal and return, about being human, how it's natural as human beings to have a center, we go out, we get some new stuff, we come back, we process it, we throw some of it away, we keep some of it, we go out again. Although institutions tend to stay where they are, right?
No? Actually, if you look at the history of organizations, institutions are dying all the time and reborn. Bill was here. Bill Davis is a child psychiatrist. He was talking to me yesterday about the fact that, you know, he's burning out on being the head of this child psychiatry unit in Minnesota. And he's come to the place where, and he knows he's eventually going to have to stop. The problem is there's no child psychiatrist to come in and replace him. If he goes away, that institution will die. But what he's come to this place of, which I think is just absolutely marvelous, is the notion that, you know, if I go away and that particular institution dies, something else will have to fill that space. Mm-hmm. The need to be gifted is there. The need is still there. Mm-hmm. So somewhere, somebody's going to come in and gift it.
And that's Marshall's at the end of this article about God walking around the
God
church and letting it die. Comes back there.
But it's that fear of death. It's the fear of death, I think, that gets us into these kind of crazy...
This is into trouble, right?
This is into trouble.
The death itself, that's what he says.
Right.
The death will be the ashes from which the resurrection will be found, you know, and out of which will come the new and better... Coming death of the church need not mean the demise of Christianity in the West. Rather, the church's acceptance of its death is its only hope for life. The love of God's servants for the rubble we have made of the church will not be in vain. As Psalm 102 continues, the nations will fear the name of the Lord and all the kings of the earth your glory, for the Lord will build up Zion again and appear in all his glory.
Rebirth will happen. You don't know what it's going to look like. But if you have the faith that rebirth will happen, you can do the...
Then it's
and you
okay.
can do that's the exploring.
Okay. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
okay.
Yeah, that's good. Trigger something in anybody else? I've been doing more than my share of talking here.
Well, when the rubber hits the road, I do outreach to shelters, mental health outreach to homeless shelters. And some of them are Lutheran and some of them are the Salvation Army, whatever that is, I'm not sure. And then there's a Catholic shelter that I go to, and the nurses in that shelter with me are not allowed to offer alternative birth control options to the adolescents who come into that shelter. We can't hand out condoms, and we can't teach basic birth control stuff to the kids. And I used to go to the Catholic Church, and I used to be a Missouri Synod Lutheran, and I've been a Presbyterian, and I'm now a Methodist. It's like, go! can't the Catholics get it together? I know it's not all of them, but geez, we have to see that there's all these children around with all these needs, and these children having children, and now I have to deal with this. And it's not like I want to blame anybody, but it's painful.
Well, but probably the best way to help Catholics see, get your insight, is to feast on theirs. I really think everybody's got their gifts.
Well, I know that. So how do I do that?
How do I do that? You have to somehow find...
Abstinence is not an option.
What? What did you say?
Oh, abstinence. Oh, I...
Abstinence is not
an option. I know, he doesn't want me to practice that.
We need contact.
Yeah.
We need contact with each other, and what's truthful and good will spread. And if we have some insight, but what doesn't happen is when we seek the contact in order to give somebody the answers we think we've got that they need, it doesn't happen.
No, I know
if,
that.
If we,
I know that.
Now that's why to discover what is rich and good and strong and valuable and worthy for you of the Catholic Church is probably the best way to set up the dynamic that eventually some Catholics you have contact with can draw from you some insight about what the limits that they're up against are. That help?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You have to work through that stuff.
I wonder if part of the problem is our discomfort as humans with mystery and with the immenseness of God and God's creation. And I think as humans, we're most comfortable when we can kind of understand everything and explain everything, at least to ourselves. And it seems like each denomination has kind of erected, boundaries, some sort of structural framework that allows them to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then another group over here does it, but their structural framework isn't exactly the same. And it's so because we're trying to encapsulate the infinite in our finite mental conceptual structures that we get into trouble if we just kind of left room for some mystery and admit to ourselves, hey, we don't understand everything.
And there's where I'm suggesting, as we, because I'm arguing against approaching the ecumenical movement as some kind of institutional merger, and in favor of just seeking the broadest diversity we can find in our fellowship, in koinonia. To go there, you're gonna encounter a lot of stuff you can't handle. I talked a couple of days ago about the two churches in South Africa, the Western model of Christianity and the African Christianity. And I was teaching in an Anglican seminary here, but I was interested in this culturally African expression of Christianity. Well, when I started finding myself, in worship led by polygamous bishops, that was hard for me, And there's where I think you know, there's where a lot of relations would break down right away. You're sinning. That's wrong. You can't go there. And I'm not going to have anything to do with you because you do that. But to say that, I really have to be perfect myself. You know, let him without sin cast the first stone. So I like to just, what I don't understand, just don't deal with it. So, I mean, in a way, just don't go there. I went into those communities looking for what I thought they, what value they had, not what mistakes they made. Now, at some point, you got to draw some lines about, or do you? I don't know.
Well, I struggle with that same exact issue in my work, and where I go to is, I'm not a saint.
You're not?
I'm not a saint.
A saint.
I'm not Jesus.
Right.
You know, I there are lines for me. I can't find the humanity in every single situation.
Okay.
I strive for it.
Okay.
I work to get there. But there are certain situations where I go, you know, I can't, because to me that is the process of not just finding what I need, but the process of their pain or their suffering, because that's what, when you see these other things, it's that's what's underneath.
Okay, that's
I gotta connect to,
right.
For me to connect to them as a human, at the human, base human, we're all God's children level, I've gotta find that part in me. And frankly, I'm not strong enough. Mm-hmm. To go there.
But what I like about that is that you're not going there isn't based on a judgment that they're bad
well, that's
they're good.
Starts.
It's quite the opposite. You're saying
I'm
not a saint. I'm not big enough
right.
to
I'm not saying dynamically I'm a human. I have the judgmental reaction and then I catch myself and I go, okay, now what's underneath the judgment? And that's the pain. And, you know, and then I can get to that place and go, I can't. Judgment, pain, but I can't. I'm not big enough.
Yeah.
Well, that's the attitude I love. She is, but I'm not.
In keeping with my philosophy that we get drawn to, that we're self-interested creatures and that we ought to have something practical that attracts us here. I want to, having especially spoken against institutional mergers, put in a plug for institutions, ecumenical institutions that we need. I think I mentioned in one of the sessions this week that my board of directors had a retreat last fall analyzing what support we get and don't get from the religious community. One guy said, well, if nobody supports, if there's no religious support for ecumenical institutions, maybe we should just join one church, you know, and at least we'd get something from someone for financial support.
Differentiation.
It's true that ecumenical, there isn't much support constituency for ecumenical institutions. And, when we were, Seacrest House was founded by the Episcopal Church, and I'll leave some literature about it for those of you interested in that maritime ministry in Florida that I work at. It was founded by the Episcopal Church, and as long as it was an Episcopal-owned institution, it got Episcopal support. As soon as it became an ecumenical institution, then that went almost down to nothing. And we don't get really any support from the ELCA institutions. We get from some congregations. Local congregations, but nothing from the synod, because we're not a Lutheran institution. Mm-hmm. Even though there's a Lutheran pastor, the director, but that's, you know, it's questionable.
Even though you're doing Lutheran work, supposedly.
Or some Lutheran,
yeah.
Oiko Credit is a great ecumenical institution. You can read about it, learn about it at oikocredit.org. Oiko comes from the word oikumene, and it's an outgrowth of the World Council of Churches, which started as a development bank. In 1968, young people at the Uppsala WCC Worldwide Convention or Conference challenged the churches. 68 was Vietnam and everything. They challenged the churches to stop passing peace-oriented resolutions and putting all their investments in companies that were building bombs and profiting from war making. And that the challenge by youth at that assembly led to a study process, as always happens in religious communities. And out of that came a decision to form a development bank, an ecumenical development bank, that would make loans to poor people's cooperatives around the world. And because credit in many parts of the world, we pay, what, 6, 8, 10, 12% on a bank loan. But in many parts of the world, people are paying 30, 40% if they can get the credit. And cooperatives often can't. So they said, we're going to take some religious money from the churches, the investments, and encourage churches to put some of their investments to look for more than a financial return on their investment, to invest in development, in human development. One of the great things it provides is a development education. If you invest in OICO credit, you get back knowledge and learning about the economic realities facing people around the world that is so precious. OICO credit has done much better among the European churches than in the United States. In the United States, clergy pension funds want a dollar return on their money. And they're not even willing to put much at all in, or anything substantial. In Europe, individuals became major investors beyond churches. It hasn't taken off much in the States yet, although there's some good curve to the growth that's happening now. But I recommend it because some of that diversity in fellowship that we've got to seek is on all kinds of axes, north, south, black, white, you know, it's race, it's language, it's nationality, it's gender, it's sexual orientation. It's got to be economic. It's just too convenient for the economically privileged to not include that kind of diversity in the diversities that we hunger for. It's just too convenient. And oikocredit.org is a great example of what can happen when different people find some institutional means of collaborating, working together. And I also recommend Seafarers House. The ambition to be more multi-faith is bigger than the reality at this point. We have Jewish and some Muslim involvement, very tough in the security environment that we're in right now. To deal with that, the couple of the, you know, the hijackers on 9/11, a couple of them were hanging out just a few miles from Port Everglades, where I work, and I mean, you have a major electric generating station and the largest petroleum tank farms in the whole southeastern United States, and cruise ships with thousands of passengers from this decadent. Industry decadent from the point of view of some fundamentalists. So there's some, you know, and they're very, how do you open up and welcome all Muslims to come and volunteer at Seafarers House under those circumstances? But because we're right between the tank, the jet fuel tanks and the electricity generating station, and quarter mile from where the cruise ships are.
Wow.
Right in the middle. It would be a great place to launch an attack. And I think that's all I have to share. Anybody else? God, the Spirit has to be moving in somebody's hearts here to, with some kind of an insight other than my own to share, or should we just close? It's urgent that we grow the circles that we live in.
I wonder if you had to also be, and I'm not skilled at this, at confrontation, a positive confrontation, because when circumstances come up and there are incidences that'll happen, I don't always face it and challenge it with maybe with the person. Even, you know, not even just a whole institution, just a person. Have you heard of Florida, the Give Kids the World?
No.
It's a gentleman who started with his own money, when they fly children from, or children fly, come from all over the United States who have cancer or, you know, diseases that they will most likely die from, and they go to, they're taken, there's a village, and I don't know all about it. David, do you know all the specifics about what they do there? I think they offer them meals, a place to stay.
Yeah, take them to, usually,
Disney.
Where in Orlando they go to Disney World, usually they write in and say what they'd like to do, and then the organization tries to make that be possible.
Sort of like Make-A-Wish
Foundation. Make-A-Wish, right, right. And we have neighbors who serve as part of this organization and are very involved and believe that this man has done a wonderful thing. And yet, when they're explaining it to me, they said they pray for him, for the organizer, because he's not going to be going to heaven because he's Jewish and he doesn't believe in Jesus.
Oh, dear.
And I'm stumped because I just think
I believe God, I believe salvation is a gift of God's grace and that God gives it to us. There's nothing we can do to get it for ourselves.
Right.
Yeah. One of the things I think we've talked about some already is that push and pull between maybe some of the community support aspects of congregations and denominations, that in some ways it fuels the ability to be giving in the world and to maintain. And so there's this push and pull. I mean, we have a lot of friends who are not connected to any faith community, and think that if you are, you probably hook, line, and sinker, think all the things that are involved in that.
You're limited by that.
And so we usually have more in common with people who are rooted in some sort of community, whatever it is, than we do with people, except for ones that say every other community is unable to be saved. And so sometimes in this society, that can be one of the biggest divisions. Between people who say, yeah, that God works to build community among us despite our differences, and then you can go to some ecumenical cooperation. I think one of the hardest things is to try to deal with people who have no sense of God working in community. And, I don't know. That's just
who can't? Yeah, because without that, how do you accept the mystery that Tom's talking about? And that's what I need God for.
Everybody has pain.
Yeah.
That's where I mean, people who don't have a faith, you start with the pain.
Yeah, that's a good
point.
Yeah.
It's always there.
David, what do you say to the Christian exclusionists who quote the gospel passage that no one comes to the Father but by me?
Yeah, I heard a great sermon on that. I would say that, go back to what I said about Jesus being the radical inclusivist, and that that what Jesus is referring to there is that without a radical inclusion of the whole, you are apart from God. You can't be only as one can we reflect the one God. And that any partial that's what Jesus was referring to there. Because the model of sameness, unity by sameness, is intellectual folly. It doesn't exist. We fool ourselves into thinking we're more or less the same, but we never are. So it's one or the other. It's either a unity of sameness or it's an organic unity in which the whole is God's. God didn't create part of the world, so there's this part that can be with God, and the others are outside of it. But it's a tough sell. I've been up against it for most of my life, and I haven't.
Because those people would say, it's our duty to go get the rest,
and bring them in through our door so that they can be part of it. Because otherwise, too bad for them.
Right. But then keep in mind what I said about, then you're down the slippery slope of, I earned my salvation by believing the right things.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And we don't. It's a gift.
I have been using lately a little saying by Thich Nhat Hanh, which is very difficult to. It's an easy saying that everyone will agree with, I think, but it's very difficult when it comes to practice like this. He says, when we look, the purpose of worshiping together is to look deeply together. When we come to look deeply together and to find out that we are all one. And what I notice is how many times in music, as I'm a musician, we sing the words that say in one way or another, and even it's in our scriptures, make us one. And I wonder to myself, how do we mean that? Because making us one often becomes this thing of, what can we do this? And when I hear him say this, and he brings it up many, many times, and he says, I just look a little more deeply, and then I see we are one. We breathe the same air. We live or die together with what we do on our planet. We are one. And it seems easy, but then when I try to fit that in with the way I've been brought up and Christian teaching and all those kind of things, part of me also wants to say, well, we're not acting as one, and that's what we want to make us one. But it's a tricky thing. But I think that's a much deeper, thing that I'm hearing, and that just seems very Jesus-y,
Exactly.
Jesus-y. Yeah, it's Jesus-y.
Yeah, that's, being one doesn't mean being the same. That's the thing. That's right. We can be one and be different.
Actually,
one
in our diversity. Actually, in every other sector of life, of creation, the diversity is essential.
Right.
In biology, the diversity is essential.
That's what makes it.
You remove one element of the system, and the whole system gets sick. And as human beings, we are not complete, right? Otherwise, what about the rest of life? Yeah. We could probably go on a long time. Thank you for sharing.
Glasses to see by.
Yeah.